proudly served as a U.S. Senator for the great state of California. KABC is honored to welcome former Senator and Friday night special host, Barbara Boxer.
Thank you for that introduction. I think it's the best one I've ever had. So thank you, KABC, Talk Radio 790, News Talk. Actually, it's News Talk Evolve. That's why I'm here, because you're evolving. And I hope you're evolving in a really good way. You know, anytime you feel like it, you can call us at 800-222-5222. So, yes, this is Barbara Boxer, that Barbara Boxer, you know, the one who represented you for 24 years in the United States Senate. Before that, I was in the House for 10 years. Before that, I was in local government for 6 years. And now I am uncensored, untethered, unleashed. And here I am. So, yes, that Barbara Boxer, the one you either loved, liked, hated, or never heard of. And that's, you know, you fit in one of those categories. So I have to tell you that since I left the Senate on January 3rd, when my successor, Kamala Harris, got sworn in, I was very proud. She took the seat that I held, and I expanded my political action committee because I think times call for me to still be out there with my voice. I've been on a book tour with my new book, The Art of Tough. I hope you buy it. I hope you like it. I've been giving speeches all over the place. And tonight, I am so pleased to be hosting our Friday night special on KABC Talk Radio 790. And again, I really hope you call us, because that makes it so much interesting, even if you make it tough on me. I wrote that book, The Art of Tough. I know how to give it right back. So don't be afraid to call me. Of course, if you love me, call me. What can I say? Either way, it's 800-222-5222. Well, we have a really great lineup tonight. We start off with Professor Fernando Guerra from Loyola Marymount University. He's a professor of political science. And we're going to talk about one of my favorite and challenging topics. How did our two great political parties get so far apart? I have my own theory on it. I really want to know what he thinks, because I'm sure he has thought a lot about it. And maybe he can teach me something, and maybe we can have a good dialogue, and maybe you can call in and see who you agree with. Then later in the show, we have our new California Attorney General, Javier Becerra. He was in Congress for many years. He was actually in the leadership of Congress. And he's going to talk about how he views our new president's executive orders. And I'm going to ask him what he thinks President Trump means when he says California is out of control. Frankly, I'm glad California is out of his control, but we'll talk more about that with Javier. And then we have Phil Bronstein, who heads the Center for Investigative Reporting. And we're going to discuss Trump's attack on our free press. So we've got a fabulous lineup, and I'm just so honored to be able to talk to these good people. So why don't we welcome our first guest, Professor Guerra. Are you there, Professor?
Having me.
Well, I'm thrilled. I'm thrilled. And, you know, when I asked the producers of the show if they could find someone who could be an expert on this, it's kind of my quest to understand what happened to these parties. So I have my own theories, but I want to start off and ask you, why do you think we have this divide in the parties, which is reflected in the divide in our nation?
I think it's a variety of different trends that have kind of manifested themselves, emerged to this point. I'm hopeful that in the future they'll come a little bit closer together, but I'm not surprised right now that they're so far apart. And they have to do with some major trends, which are, you know, demographic, the urban and rural divide, ethnic divide. And so you have an increasingly almost kind of a segregation of political ideology. So, for instance, in California and in Los Angeles, we at Loyola Marymount University conduct a survey, and we took what we consider the top 10 wedge issues nationally. And we found that in Los Angeles, wedge issues actually don't exist. There's an incredible consensus, and it would be defined in a conventional sense as very liberal democratic, right? And we see that not only in this the survey results that Angelenos are very far left, but also in election results and party registration, to the point right now where Republicans only have 15% of registered voters in Los Angeles. Donald Trump only got 16% of the vote in the city of Los Angeles. And then you can go on further that the county of Los Angeles only has 19% registered Republicans, and the state of California only 27%. And so you can see that California, not, you know, as the rest of the country got a little bit more red, California got even more blue. And people say, wow, that's, you know, they're living in a bubble. And that's certainly true. But increasingly, most Americans are living in a bubble. Either
let me just ask you this question. The way I grew up in politics, it was a very different point of view. I always tried to find what we all share in common. Whatever our religion, whatever we look like, whatever our economic status, what do we want? It seems to be a very simple point. And this is why I am surprised at where we are today, because I think people all want to have good jobs. They want to have health care. They want to make sure their kids can get a good education. They want to breathe clean air. You know, environmentalism, that was really a very bipartisan issue. Now, I go back a long ways. I'm talking about when I started out in the 70s, Republicans were the ones who were leading the way. They called themselves conservationists because it was conservative to say we want to protect this beauty that we have and the air that we breathe and the water that we drink. So we were all together, and all of a sudden now, and I don't think this has anything to do with demographics, the Republican Party as a whole is so much against preserving the environment that Donald Trump appointed someone who got through who sued the Environmental Protection Agency over and over. As a matter of fact, today I tweeted, now that we have a new head of the EPA who always sues the EPA, is he going to sue himself? You know, Mr. Pruitt. So let's take that as an example. Why would that now be an issue where the parties are separated?
Well, actually, again, going back to a public opinion survey, when you do a survey and you even ask Republicans on some very general issues in terms of what we want, and I think you expressed it really well, what is it that Americans want?
Yeah.
You see that they, whether it's Democrat or Republican, African-American or white, Asian or Latino, they all tend to say the same thing, that they want good jobs, good schools, good neighborhoods, et cetera. And so on those very top of line issues, there is actually very broad consensus, not only in California, but in America. What then it begins to take the difference is how to achieve that. And for instance, the environment, it's a great example. Most Republicans will say, of course, we want a good environment. But then the steps they take lead to, in the short term, definitely not improved environmental quality. And that's where it breaks down in terms of how to get to that goal in the sense that we all share. And I think the difference in America today is not that we have different goals, but we really have different means in terms of how to get there. And I think the interests have really impacted the definition of those means and have truly impacted, especially on the Republican side, the definition of what is good or bad policy to get to where all of us agree we need to be.
Well, I just want to press you because I've listened to your words and I'm saying, what does this all mean? It sounds so good. But here's what I'm saying. You say everybody says they want clean air, clean water. You're absolutely right. I mean, everybody does. My Republican colleagues do. But then they now say they want to do away with the Environmental Protection Agency. As a matter of fact, that bill has been introduced. And they want to, for example, in with the standing sue in the Dakotas, they don't think it's bad to threaten the water supply of that Native American tribe. And I take a different view of this on the environment, because I can tell you, when I took the chair of the Environment and Public Works Committee in 2008, I was thrilled to have my Republican colleagues come forward, and I even made a book of it because I had a sense I wanted to keep this forever, and I have it in my archives. Great speeches put in that record by my Republican friends, Olympia Snowe, the great senator from Maine, John McCain, Judd Gregg from the Northeast Corridor, and others who said climate change is real, we have to act, and we were on a roll. And all of a sudden, it changed. And they became either deniers or they decided they didn't want to do it. So my theory, and I want to see what you think, I have a hunch you may not agree with me, I think the special interests, oil, coal, you know, gas, they're just not interested in moving to clean energy, which is, as you know, the solution to saving this planet. I mean, that's 97% of scientists who tell us this. And I think it's because they just get so much support from these very powerful entities like the Koch brothers and so on. They're afraid they'll get primaried if they don't back away. So I don't think it's just a question of, well, they have different means to getting to a clean environment. I think they've thrown up their hands and said, you know, I just got to be good to big oil and the big energy. And I wonder how you feel about it.
Well, no, I think I very much agree with your sentiment. And it's not, you know, I don't think it's a theory. I think it's a fact. When you take a look at how far to the right the Republican Party has moved, and it's been doing that for a variety of different factors, but the whole primary, the Tea Party was able to push the agenda to the right very much, to the point where now, you know, we have a president like Donald Trump, and he makes someone like Congressman Ryan, the speaker, seem a moderate, when,
yes,
you know, 10 years ago, we would have thought of him as a very much right wing and not even capable of being part of Republican leadership. But now he's the moderate.
That's and right. Now, and, yes. And he's at risk of getting primary, too.
Right. Correct. And then people on the right will say, well, that's the same thing that's been happening to the Democrats. And I think it's a false equivalent. I don't think that's the case at all.
Thank you. Will you say that again? Will you say that again, Professor?
Yeah, that it is a false equivalent in terms of Democrats have, I think, stuck to a variety of very core issues, whereas the Republican Party has, if you take a look at their base, even when you take a look at what congressmen in a variety of different congressional districts say and what their residents feel, it's very different. And they feel that just because they won the election, given the lack of choice, that their constituents believe in the policies that they're pursuing, they're misreading the results, and they're just it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. They say, look, this is what I believe, and they voted for me. No, they didn't have any choice.
I hear
they were,
you. I want to bring up another very sensitive issue, which a lot of people don't talk about, but I'm going to talk about a woman's right to choose. And what I want to say about that is that when I was coming up in politics, again, this was not a partisan issue in any way, shape, or form. As a matter of fact, I mean, I hate to remind the Republicans out there, it was George Herbert Walker Bush who sat on the board of Planned Parenthood. And again, it was a conservative stand. Let's make sure that people get birth control, that people can have their families when they want it. It was a conservative movement. And I joined in because, not that I was conservative, but because I respect women and their families, and I think it's between them, their family, their doctor, and their God. And I've always believed that. And then we get to a circumstance where they're zeroing out Planned Parenthood money. The Republicans are. They've passed a bill already to do it. And I want to make a statement here, and it's a fact. It's not an alternative fact. It's a fact. Millions, millions of women and men get their top line health care from Planned Parenthood. 97% of what Planned Parenthood does is preventive care. They make sure you get those breast exams, those STDs exams. They make sure you get your birth control. And with their private funding, not a dime of federal money, they're not allowed to. Yes, they do help a woman if she chooses to end that pregnancy early in her pregnancy when it is allowed. So I don't get that either. And
yeah.
I don't understand why we became so, you know, this became a partisan issue. Do you have a sense why?
I mean, to even to add to what you're talking about is not only was George Herbert Bush on Planned Parenthood, but there was Democrats who were actually very pro-life and were able to still function. I mean, I'm sure you remember Dave Roberti.
I sure do.
Who was president pro tem of the California Senate for 10 years, basically during the same time that Willie Brown was speaker. And he was very pro-life, took being a Catholic to a certain extent, but yet it didn't prevent him from functioning and even being chosen as the leader of the Democrats.
You know what? You're right, and we are a big tent, and we still have people who feel that way personally. Now, we're coming up on a break, but Professor, I'm so glad you're on the show. Will you stick with us so we can continue this conversation?
Sure, absolutely.
All right, we're coming up on a break. Everybody, remember to call us, 800-222-5222.
Now, back to the Friday Night Special with Barbara Botzer on 790 KABC.
How do you like that? I love it.
Welcome back to the KABC Friday Night Special. Our call number is 800-222-5222. And this is Barbara Botzer. Yes, that Barbara Botzer, your former senator for 24 years. And by the way, if you voted for me, thank you. And if you didn't vote for me, thank you anyway, because you've been great critics and I've learned a lot. I've learned patience, I've learned humility, and I've learned to be tough when I have to be. So thank you very much all. Now, we are speaking with Professor Guerra from Loyola Marymount University. Professor, you still with us?
Yes, I am.
I'm so happy. How about we take a call? I'll let you handle it and I'll step in if you need assistance here.
So if I need to be tough, I'll let you handle it.
Well, you could be tough. So could we put on Rick from Lake Balboa? Hi, Rick.
Hey, how's you guys going? How's it going?
We're going so great, and we'd like you to talk with the professor. So tell us your question.
Okay, well, here's a setup for you, and it's going to take a while to lead to the question, but it'll be worth it. Okay?
But we don't have too much time because we're heading
right,
to the news, so
quick.
Try to make it fast.
Okay, regarding minimum wage.
Yes.
Let's say I'm a restaurant owner, okay? I make 5 to 7% on my dollar. I'm not a fat, rich capitalist pig, okay? I've negotiated a contract with my employees to work for a certain amount of money. No one put a gun to their head. They're happy working there, and I'm happy having them, okay? Now, what right does the government have to come in and say, you know what, I don't think you're paying them enough? Excuse me? I don't think so. And what's going to happen? I won't hire. I'll cut back hours. I'll hire part-time. They won't get benefits.
Okay, I get it. I totally get your question. And I'm going to start off, and I'm going to turn to the professor. We hear this all the time. When I was a kid, the minimum wage was, I swear to God, 75 cents an hour. And with that attitude, never would have been raised because it's always raised. But we've managed to grow this economy and people have to be able to live dignified lives. But I know it's tough and I know you have to make accounts for this. And it may change the way you hire and it may change the way you price. I get it all. But at the end of the day, there is a federal minimum wage and it has kept people out of total poverty. And I would ask the professor if he'd like to add a word here.
Sure. I mean, not only do we have the federal wage, but we also have a state wage, and now we have minimum wages like cities of Los Angeles, San Francisco, and even the county of Los Angeles. And certainly, I think the caller, there are going to be winners and losers. And unfortunately, somebody has to be that referee, and that is the role of government. It has to determine that for the sake of the greater good, for the movement of society, the economy, that it has to make certain decisions. And clearly, when you ask the residents of the city of Los Angeles and the county of Los Angeles and California, they are overwhelmingly in support of increasing the minimum wage. Will it negatively impact some businesses? Yes. Will it have a specific focus on certain sectors like the restaurant that are going to negatively be impacted? Absolutely. But overall, it will be a positive and it will lead to a greater economic growth for most of California and Los Angeles, for instance.
Yeah, and I think
so
the important
part, sympathetic yes. to the caller, the yes. big picture clearly means that we need to increase the minimum wage.
Professor, I just want to add this. You know, people always say that people on the minimum wage are kids. They're not. If 60% of people on the minimum wage
anymore,
are older
right?
women, yes. And I just, call me old-fashioned, but I don't think someone who works full-time with the sweat of their brow in a hot kitchen should have to live in poverty. And I do believe when we ask the average person, would you pay a little bit more for a burger? You know what they say? They will. And that's the beauty of our great nation. We are a compassionate nation. We understand these things. Because if we have a permanent situation where people live at the bottom of the ladder and they have no hope, it doesn't help. And the last point I'd make, 70% of our economy is when people spend money. So when that minimum wage worker gets a raise, it doesn't stay in their pocket. It goes right out to the local grocery store. It goes right out to the local pharmacy. So I have to wrap it up. I'm so grateful for the call. I'm so grateful to you, Professor. And we will be right back. Welcome back. Welcome back to Friday Night Special with me. Yes, that Barbara Boxer. The one you either that you either loved and sent wonderful messages to, or the one you said, oh my God, how did you ever get there? But I am so honored to be here tonight. We had a wonderful first guest who I think added so much to our conversation. But right now, I am so excited to welcome to our show our new California Attorney General, Javier Becerra. He is our chief law enforcement officer in California. And before I get him on the line, I think it's important to note that fate is so interesting because if I had decided to run again in 2016, Kamala Harris would still be attorney general. But because I didn't run, Kamala Harris gets elected, and then there's an opening, and Javier Becerra gets appointed. So we are forever tied in this very interesting triangle with Kamala. But this is a person I know very well. This is a fine, fine gentleman. This is a man who served in the Congress for a long time. He was actually in the leadership. And to get him tonight, I think, is so wonderful. I know he's hectic. He's at an event, but he's doing it because his friend Barbara Boxer asked him. And Javier, welcome to the show.
Senator Boxer, great always to be with you, Barbara. And I don't know if I'll ever stop calling you Senator Boxer.
Well, you know what? I guess once a senator, always a senator. But you can call me anything you want as long as it's clean. It's fine. I answer to a lot of things. Sometimes my husband, Stu, of 55 years, when he really wants to get my attention, says Senator, and I turn around. What can I say?
Well, and I should remind you as well that I got elected to Congress the year you got elected to the Senate, because that was the year of the woman, if you recall, that 1992 election.
That was really something. And, you know, I always thought that was overstated, Javier, because we did triple the number of women in the United States Senate, but we went from 2 to 6. And
yeah.
They said, oh, my God, 2 to 6. It's the year of the woman. So let's see. We have 100 senators and 6 were women. They called it the year of the woman. But now we have about 20. So
yes.
We're making progress, but not enough and not fast enough in my view. Well, I want to talk to you about some serious things, and we are so honored, and we thank you so much for taking time out. But you left Congress, and now you see what this president is doing. And I'm not talking about his rhetoric. I'm talking about actual things he's done. And I'll go through a few of them, and then we can talk about what you think. Besides turning on the press, and that's a whole other topic I'm going to talk about later tonight with a great guest. But the first executive order he signed was to raise the cost of mortgages for FHA loans to middle-income people. I was kind of stunned because those are the people who voted for him. Then he repealed a rule that stopped toxics from coal mining from contaminating rivers and streams. That was How do you make America great again with that when people can't drink the water? Then he repealed a rule that said severely mentally ill people can't buy guns. These are people who are so severely impacted that they're on Social Security disability for their mental health challenges. Then he changed the definition, really, of what undocumented folks who are here, who will be protected, and on and on. And then he says California is out of control. What do you think he means by that? I don't know what he means. How are we out of control, Mr. Attorney General?
Barbara, that's beyond me to understand. All I know is that California has become now the sixth largest economy in the world. If we were our own country, there would only be five countries, including the U.S., who would be in front of us as an economic engine, creating jobs and prosperity for its people. And so you don't become the sixth economic power in the world by being out of control. You become that mighty engine by doing the right things for the people in your state. And that's what California has done. And so, as you just said, it's not a matter of what Donald Trump as president says. It's not his rhetoric that will, at the end of the day, determine what happens in this country. It's what he does. And I'm not going to worry about what he says.
Mm-hmm.
I will worry about what he does.
I hear you. And I think it's important, a point worth mentioning, that in fiscal matters, we're very much in control. I mean, we've got a balanced budget. We've got a surplus, right? And
we do.
And we've got very low unemployment, and we're following the science on climate. So when he says we're out of control, frankly, I take it as a compliment, because clearly his values are not the values I grew up with as an immigrant kid. My mother was born in Austria. I'm first generation. I kiss the ground of this country. I think this country is the greatest. So can you stick with us? Because we really need you to stick with us, can you? Because we got some
Absolutely.
More talk to do. Okay, we'll be right back. Hi, everybody. It is so much fun to be doing this. Many years ago, way back when I was going to leave public life, I was going to do talk radio. And I was on a sister station, KGO Radio, up north. And they gave me, of course, I was very young and very green, and they gave me the 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. slot. I'll tell you, that was an experience of a lifetime. I learned to deal with a lot of interesting people. So here's the deal. We have on the line with us, and I'm so proud, California's top law enforcement officer, Javier Becerra. And Javier and I are good friends. We served together in Washington, he in the Congress, me in the Senate. And Javier, would you take this call from a caller, Brenda from Burbank? Are you with us?
Yes, ma'am. Hello, how are you, Senator Buckler?
Oh, hi. Hi, Brenda. Could you ask this question? I'm going to ask Javier to take a swing at it, and then I'll... We lost Javier. Okay. Well, I will have to step in.
Well, Mike, well...
Oh, did we lose Brenda? First we lost Javier. Then we lost Brenda.
I'm back.
Oh, Javier's back and Brenda's gone. So then I will ask you this question, because several people have called in and said they wanted me to ask you this question. As a legal expert, what did you think of when the travel ban was announced by President Trump, which was, he said it was running very smoothly. Clearly, if you watched anything, you saw the chaos at the airports. This was a ban against seven nations, all Muslim majority nations. As a legal person, I'm married to a lawyer, my son's a lawyer, my dad was a lawyer. I'm not a lawyer, but I sort of have it via my bloodstream. But what did you think when you heard about it?
Barbara, didn't take very long to know that it was an overreach beyond what the Constitution would permit. As I said at the beginning, all Donald Trump had to do was read the Constitution, and he would have seen that what he was proposing was not allowable, because he was targeting people based on a particular issue that is unconstitutional, their origin or their religion. And it's pretty simple. If you read the Constitution, you can't do those things in the Bill of Rights as well.
It's the Establishment Clause, the First Amendment. It is. You're right. It's clear. It's very, very clear. So you knew. But it was really interesting to see that fight develop. And he said, see you in court. Well, they were in court. And so
we saw them in court.
We saw them in court. And now it looks as if they've backed down and they're writing a new order. Do you have any sense of what that might look like or what you think it should look like?
I have no idea what they will do. I certainly know this, that executive orders have to be very narrowly tailored. They have to be within the confines of the existing law, and certainly they must respect the Constitution. President Obama did the executive order on the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, what we call the DACA program for Dreamers in this country. It was narrowly tailored, and what essentially it said was, in enforcing the existing laws, this is how I'm going to do it. I'm going to prioritize going after the felons, not the families. And so Donald Trump, if he wants to have an executive order that will pass the constitutional test and will respect existing laws, has to make sure he stays within the confines of what we have as today's laws and Constitution.
You're so right. And, you know, we need to, all these branches of government are checks and balances on the other. And it's very clear that this president has to understand that. You just can't go off on your own. Congress can't go off on its own. The courts really are watching to make sure that we are loyal and true to the Constitution. And I was just thinking, nobody's against vetting. We all want to make sure we take our time when anyone's coming into this country. And, you know, President Obama instituted very strong vetting. Some of the people that are coming over in the refugee program have had to wait 2 years. And, you know, the one thing, I don't know if you saw that, where you had this Iranian woman mother with her baby. The baby had like two or three holes in her heart and needed an operation. And everyone was waiting for them. I believe it was in Oregon where the family was waiting to get that child that operation. And the woman was turned away. And I thought, you know, this is not making our country safe. This is not making our country great. But let me ask you, because you brought up the issue of DACA and making sure that these children who came here as immigrants at very young ages, 1 year old, 2 years old, 14 years old, that they are allowed to stay here. President Trump was asked about that, and he said, oh, this is a very tough issue for me. And I said to myself, why? Why is it a tough issue? It's a no-brainer issue. These people are our citizens. They've been with us. And I don't know why. And then he says, well, I have to work with the Congress. Well, I'm going to ask you something. You served for a long time in the Congress. Don't you think if he embraced DACA that he would get a strong bipartisan vote? We would be able to pass that in a heartbeat if he said, let's do it legislatively.
In a heartbeat. Because there is bipartisan support for it. There has been for a long time.
Yeah.
And it's a very compelling case, as you said. These are kids who probably don't know the home country of their parents. And so they have grown up here. Many have become valedictorians in high school. Many have gone on to college and to do well. And in all respects, they would make us proud as American citizens. And so it's one of those things where DACA hasn't given them the legal status to stay in the country. It simply has said, we're going to defer any action against you to remove you from the country while we pursue the real folks who are trying to do us harm.
Exactly.
Here without documents.
Exactly. But yet Trump has changed that order, and now people who are really decent people are getting kicked out. Well, I love the fact that you called us. I am so proud of you. And, you know, always call on me if I can be of help. And congratulations on your appointment. And I hope you will serve us well and serve us long. Javier Becerra, California's top law enforcement officer, attorney general. Thank you so much. We're going to take a break and we'll be right back.